dawn may be brighter, and if so, we shall meet again. Take care of yourselves, and keep away from Orthanc. Goodbye."
Treebeard was very thoughtful after Gandalf had gone. He'd evidently learned a lot in a short time and was digesting it. He looked at us and said,
Well, I find you're not such hasty folk as I thought. You said much less than you might, but not more than you should. This is a bundle of news and no mistake. Well now, Treebeard must get busy again."
Before he went, we got a little news out of him, and it didn't cheer us up at all. But for the moment we thought more about you three than about Frodo and Sam, or about poor Boromir, for we gathered that there was a great battle going on, or soon would be, and that you were in it and might never come out of it.
"Horns will help," said Treebeard.
Then he went away, and we didn't see him again until this morning. It was deep night. We lay on top of a pile of stone, and we could see nothing beyond it. Mist or shadows blotted out everything like a great blanket all round us. The air seemed hot and heavy, and it was full of rustlings, creakings, and a murmur like voices passing. I think that hundreds more of the Huorns must have been passing by to help in the battle. Later there was a great rumble of thunder away south, and flashes of lightning far away across Rohan. Every now and then we could see mountain peaks, miles and miles away, stab out suddenly, black and white, and then vanish. And behind us there were noises like thunder in hills, but different. At times the whole valley echoed. It must have been about midnight when the Ents broke the dams and poured all the gathered waters through a gap in the northern wall, down into Isengard. The Huorn dark had passed, and the thunder had rolled away. The moon was sinking behind the western mountains. Isengard began to fill up with black, creeping streams and pools. They glittered in the last light of the moon as they spread over the plain. Every now and then the waters found their way down into some shaft or spout hole. Great white steams hissed up. Smoke rose in billows. There were explosions and gusts of fire. One great coil of vapour went whirling up, twisting round and round Orthanc, until it looked like a tall peak of cloud, fiery underneath and moonlit above. And still more water poured in, until at last Isengard looked like a huge flat saucepan, all steaming and bubbling.
"We saw a cloud of smoke and steam from the south last night, when we came to the mouth of Nan Cúrinir," said Aragorn. "We feared that Saruman was brewing some new devilry for us."
"Not he," said Pippin.
"He was probably choking and not laughing any more. By the morning, yesterday morning, the water had sunk down into all the holes, and there was a dense fog. We took refuge in that guard-room over there, and we had rather a fright. The lake began to overflow and pour out through the old tunnel, and the water was rapidly rising up the steps. We thought we were going to get caught like orcs in a hole, but we found a winding stair at the back of the storeroom that brought us out at the top of the arch. It was a squeeze to get out, as the passages had been cracked and half-blocked with fallen stone near the top. There we sat high up above the floods and watched the drowning of Isengard. The Ents kept on pouring in more water till all the fires were quenched and every cave filled. The fog slowly gathered together and steamed up into a huge umbrella of cloud. It must have been a mile high. In the evening, there was a great rainbow over the eastern hills, and then the sunset was blotted out by a thick drizzle on the mountainsides. It all went very quiet. A few wolves howled mournfully, far away. The Ents stopped the inflow in the night, and sent the Isen back into its old course. And that was the end of it all. Since then the water's been sinking again. There must be outlets somewhere from the caves underneath, I think. If Saruman peeps out of any of his windows, it must look an untidy, dreary mess. We felt very lonely. Not even a visible Ent to talk to in all the ruin, and no news. We spent the night up on top there, above the arch, and it was cold and damp, and we didn't sleep. We had a feeling that anything might happen at any minute. Saruman's still in his tower. There was a noise in the night, like a wind coming up the valley. I think the Ents and Horns that had been away came back then. But where they've all gone to now, I don't know. It was a misty, moisty morning when we climbed down and looked round again, and nobody was about. And that is about all there is to tell. It seems almost peaceful now, after all the turmoil, and safer too somehow, since Gandalf came back. I could sleep. They all fell silent for a while. Gimli refilled his pipe.
"There's one thing I wonder about," he said as he lit it with his flint and tinder. "Wormtongue. You told Théoden he was with Saruman. How did he get there?"
"Oh, yes, I forgot about him," said Pippin. "He didn't get here till this morning. We'd just lit the fire and had some breakfast when Treebeard appeared again. We heard him homing and calling our names outside."
"I've just come round to see how you're faring, my lads," he said, "and to give you some news. Horns have come back. All's well. Aye, very well indeed."
He laughed and slapped his thighs.
"No more orcs in Isengard, no more axes, and there will be folk coming up from the south before the day is old, some that you may be glad to see."
He'd hardly said that when we heard the sound of hoofs on the road. We rushed out before the gates, and I stood and stared, half expecting to see Strider and Gandalf come riding up at the head of an army. But out of the mist there rode a man on an old, tired horse, and he looked a queer, twisted sort of creature himself. There was no one else. When he came out of the mist and suddenly saw all the ruin and wreckage in front of him, he sat and gaped, and his face went almost green. He was so bewildered that he didn't seem to notice us at first. When he did, he gave a cry and tried to turn his horse round and ride off. But Treebeard took three strides, put out a long arm, and lifted him out of the saddle. His horse bolted in terror, and he grovelled on the ground. He said he was Grima, friend and counsellor of the king, and had been sent with important messages from Théoden to Saruman. "No one else would dare to ride through the open land so full of foul orcs," he said, "so I was sent. And I've had a perilous journey, and I'm hungry and weary. I fled far north out of my way, pursued by wolves." I caught the sideways look he gave to Treebeard, and I said to myself, "Liar." Treebeard looked at him in his long, slow way for several minutes, till the wretched man was squirming on the floor. Then at last he said,
"I was expecting you, Master Wormtongue."
The man started at that name.
"Gandalf got here first, so I know as much about you as I need, and I know what to do with you. Put all the rats in one trap," says Gandalf, "and I will. I am the master of Isengard now, but Saruman is locked in his tower, and you can go there and give him all the messages that you can think of."
"Let me go, let me go," said Wormtongue. "I know the way."
"You knew the way, I don't doubt," said Treebeard, "but things have changed here a little. Go and see."
He let Wormtongue go, and he limped off through the arch, with us close behind, until he came inside the ring and could see all the floods that lay between him and Orthanc. Then he turned to us.
"Let me go away," he whined. "Let me go away. My messages are useless now." "They are indeed," said Treebeard. "But you have only two choices, to stay with me until Gandalf and your master arrive, or to cross the water. Which will you have?"
The man shivered at the mention of his master, and put a foot into the water, but he drew back.
"I cannot swim," he said. "The water is not deep," said Treebeard. "It is dirty, but that will not harm you, Master Wormtongue. In you go now."
With that the wretch floundered off into the flood. It rose up nearly to his neck before he got too far away for me to see him. The last I saw of him was clinging to some old barrel or piece of wood. But Treebeard waded after him and watched his progress.
"Well, he has gone in," he said when he returned. "I saw him crawling up the steps like a draggled rat. There's someone in the tower still. A hand came out and pulled him in. So there he is, and I hope the welcome is to his liking. Now I must go and wash myself clean of the slime. I'll be away up on the north side, if anyone wants to see me. There's no clean water down here fit for an ant to drink or to bathe in. So I will ask you two lads to keep a watch at the gate for the folk that are coming. There'll be the Lord of the Fields of Rohan. Mark you, you must welcome him as well as you know how. His men have fought a great fight with the orcs. Maybe you know the right fashion of men's words for such a lord better than ants. There have been many lords in the green fields in my time, and I've never heard their speech or their names. They will be wanting man-food, and you know all about that, I guess. So find what you think is fit for a king to eat, if you can."
And that is the end of the story. Though I should like to know who this Wormtongue is. Was he really the king's counsellor?
"He was," said Aragorn, "and also Saruman's spy and servant in Rohan. Fate hasn't been kinder to him than he deserves. The sight of the ruin of all that he thought so strong and magnificent must have been almost punishment enough. But I fear that worse awaits him."
"Yes, I don't suppose Treebeard sent him to Orthanc out of kindness," said Merry. "He seemed rather grimly delighted with the business, and was laughing to himself when he went to get his bathe and drink. We spent a busy time after that, searching the flotsam and rummaging about. We found two or three storerooms in different places nearby, above the flood level, but Treebeard sent some ents down, and they carried off a great deal of the stuff."
"We want man-food for 25,
the ent said. "So you can see that somebody had counted your company carefully before you arrived. You three were evidently meant to go with the great people. But you wouldn't have fared any better. We kept as good as we sent, I promise you. Better, because we sent no drink."
"What about drink?" I said to the ents.
"There is water of Isen," they said, "and that is good enough for ents and men."
"But I hope that the ents may have found time to brew some of their draughts from the mountain springs, and we shall see Gandalf's beard curling when he returns." After the ents had gone, we felt tired and hungry. But we didn't grumble. Our labours had been well rewarded. It was through our search for man-food that Pippin discovered the prize of all the flotsam, those hornblower barrels. "Pipeweed is better after food," said Pippin. That is how the situation arose.
"We understand it all perfectly now," said Gimli.
"All except one thing," said Aragorn. "Leaf from the south farthing in Isengard. The more I consider it, the more curious I find it. I've never been in Isengard, but I've journeyed in this land, and I know well the empty countries that lie between Rohan and the Shire. Neither goods nor folk have passed that way for many a long year, not openly. Saruman had secret dealings with someone in the Shire, I guess. Wormtongues may be found in other houses than King Theoden's. Was there a date on the barrels?"
"Yes," said Pippin. "It was the 1417 crop. That is last year's. No, the year before, of course, now. A good year."
"Ah, well, whatever evil was afoot is over now, I hope. Or else it's beyond our reach at present," said Aragorn. "Yet I think I shall mention it to Gandalf, small matter though it may seem among his great affairs."
"I wonder what he's doing," said Merry. "The afternoon is getting on. Let's go and look around. You can enter Isengard now at any rate, Strider, if you want to. But it's not a very cheerful sight."
Chapter 10 The Voice of Saruman. They passed through the ruined tunnel and stood upon a heap of stones, gazing at the dark rock of Orthanc, and its many windows, a menace still in the desolation that lay all about it. The waters had now nearly all subsided. Here and there gloomy pools remained, covered with scum and wreckage. But most of the wide circle was bare again, a wilderness of slime and tumbled rock, pitted with blackened holes
and dotted with posts and pillars leaning drunkenly this way and that. At the rim of the shattered bowl there lay vast mounds and slopes, like the shingles cast up by a great storm, and beyond them the green and tangled valley ran up into the long ravine between the dark arms of the mountains. Across the waste they saw riders picking their way. They were coming from the north side, and already they were drawing near to Orthanc.
"There is Gandalf, and Theoden and his men," said Legolas. "Let's go and meet them."
"Walk warily," said Merry. "There are loose slabs that may tilt up and throw you down into a pit if you don't take care." They followed what was left of the road from the gates to Orthanc, going slowly, for the flagstones were cracked and slimed. The riders, seeing them approach, halted under the shadow of the rock and waited for them. Gandalf rode forward to meet them.
"Well, Treebeard and I have had some interesting discussions and made a few plans," he said, "and we've all had some much-needed rest. Now we must be going on again. I hope you companions have all rested too and refreshed yourselves."
"We have," said Merry, "but our discussions began and ended in smoke. Still we feel less ill-disposed towards Saruman than we did."
"Do you indeed?" said Gandalf. "Well, I don't. I've now a last task to do before I go. I must pay Saruman a farewell visit. Dangerous and probably useless, but it must be done. Those of you who wish may come with me, but beware, and don't jest. This isn't the time for it." "I'll come," said Gimli. "I wish to see him and learn if he really looks like you."
"And how would you learn that, Master Dwarf?" said Gandalf.
"Saruman could look like me, in your eyes, if it suited his purpose with you. And are you yet wise enough to detect all his counterfeits?"
"Well, we shall see, perhaps. He may be shy of showing himself before many different eyes together, but I've ordered all the Ents to remove themselves from sight, so perhaps we shall persuade him to come out."
"What's the danger?" asked Pippin.
"Will he shoot at us, and pour fire out of the windows, or can he put a spell on us from a distance?"
"The last is more likely, if you ride to his door with a light heart," said Gandalf. "But there's no knowing what he can do, or may choose to try. A wild beast cornered is not safe to approach, and Saruman has powers you don't guess. Beware of his voice."
They came now to the foot of Orthanc. It was black, and the rock gleamed as if it were wet. The many faces of the stone had sharp edges, as though they had been newly chiselled. A few scorings, and small flake-like splinters near the base, were all the marks that it bore of the fury of the Ents. On the eastern side, in the angle of two piers, there was a great door, high above the ground, and over it was a shuttered window, opening upon a balcony hedged with iron bars. Up to the threshold of the door there mounted a flight of 27 broad stairs, hewn by some unknown art of the same black stone. This was the only entrance to the tower, but many tall windows were cut with deep embrasures in the climbing walls. Far up they peered like little eyes in the sheer faces of the horns. At the foot of the stairs Gandalf and the king dismounted.
"I'll go up," said Gandalf. "I've been in Orthanc, and I know my peril."
"And I too will go up," said the king. "I'm old, and fear no peril any more. I wish to speak with the enemy who has done me so much wrong. Eomer shall come with me, and see that my aged feet do not falter."
"As you will," said Gandalf. "Aragorn shall come with me. Let the others await us at the foot of the stairs. They'll hear and see enough, if there's anything to hear or see." "Nay," said Gimli, "Legolas and I wish for a closer view. We alone here represent our kindreds. We also will come behind."
"Come then," said Gandalf, and with that he climbed the steps, and Theoden went beside him. The riders of Rohan sat uneasily upon their horses, on either side of the stair, and looked up darkly at the great tower, fearing what might befall their lord.
Merry and Pippin sat on the bottom step, feeling both unimportant and unsafe.
"Half a sticky mile from here to the gate," muttered Pippin. "I wish I could slip off back to the guard-room unnoticed. What did we come for? We're not wanted."
Gandalf stood before the door of Orthanc and beat on it with his staff. It rang with a hollow sound.
"Saruman! Saruman!" he cried in a loud, commanding voice. "Saruman, come forth!"
For some time there was no answer. At last the window above the door was unbarred, but no figure could be seen at its dark opening.
"Who is it?"
said a voice.
"What do you wish?"
Théoden started.
"I know that voice," he said, "and I curse the day when I first listened to it. Go and fetch Saruman, since you've become his footman, Grima Wormtongue," said Gandalf, "and don't waste our time."
The window closed. They waited. Suddenly another voice spoke, low and melodious, its very sound an enchantment. Those who listened unwarily to that voice could seldom report the words that they heard, and if they did, they wondered, for little power remained in them. Mostly they remembered only that it was a delight to hear the voice speaking. All that it said seemed wise and reasonable, and a desire awoke in them by swift agreement to seem wise themselves. When others spoke, they seemed harsh and uncouth by contrast, and if they gainsayed the voice, anger was kindled in the hearts of those under the spell. For some the spell lasted only while the voice spoke to them, and when it spoke to another they smiled, as men do who see through a juggler's trick while others gape at it. For many the sound of the voice alone was enough to hold them enthralled, but for those whom it conquered the spell endured when they were far away, and ever they heard that soft voice whispering and urging them. But none were unmoved. None rejected its pleas and its commands without an effort of mind and will, so long as its master had control of it.
"Well," it said now with gentle question, "why must you disturb my rest? Will you give me no peace at all by night or day?"
Its tone was that of a kindly heart aggrieved by injuries undeserved. They looked up, astonished, for they had heard no sound of his coming, and they saw a figure standing at the rail, looking down upon them, an old man, swathed in a great cloak, the colour of which was not easy to tell, for it changed if they moved their eyes, or if he stirred. His face was long, with a high forehead. He had deep, darkling eyes, hard to fathom, though the look that they now bore was grave and benevolent, and a little weary. His hair and beard were white, but strands of black still showed about his lips and ears.
"Like, and yet unlike," muttered Gimli.
"But come now," said the soft voice.
"Two at least of you I know by name. Gandalf I know too well to have much hope that he seeks help or counsel here. But you, Théoden, Lord of the Mark of Rohan, are declared by your noble devices, and still more by the fair countenance of the House of Eorl. A worthy son of Thengol the thrice-renowned, why have you not come before, and as a friend? Much have I desired to see you, mightiest king of western lands, and especially in these latter years, to save you from the unwise and evil counsels that beset you. Is it yet too late? Despite the injuries that have been done to me, in which the men of Rohan, alas, have had some part, still I would save you, and deliver you from the ruin that draws nigh inevitably if you ride upon this road which you've taken. Indeed, I alone can aid you now."
Théoden opened his mouth as if to speak, but he said nothing. He looked up at the face of Saruman with its dark, solemn eyes bent down upon him, and then to Gandalf at his side, and he seemed to hesitate. Gandalf made no sign, but stood silent as stone, as one waiting patiently for some call that has not yet come. The rider stirred at first, murmuring with approval of the words of Saruman, and then they too were silent, as men spellbound. It seemed to them that Gandalf had never spoken so fair and fittingly to their lord. Rough and proud now seemed all his dealings with Théoden, and over their hearts crept a shadow, the fear of a great danger, the end of the mark in a darkness to which Gandalf was driving them, while Saruman stood beside a door of escape, holding it half open, so that a ray of light came through. There was a heavy silence. It was Gimli the dwarf who broke it suddenly.
"The words of this wizard stand on their heads," he growled, gripping the handle of his axe. "In the language of Orthanc, help means ruin, and saving means slaying. That is plain. But we don't come here to beg."
"Peace," said Saruman,
and for a fleeting moment his voice was less suave, and a light flickered in his eyes and was gone.
"I do not speak to you yet, Gimli Glóin's son," he said. "Far away is your home, and small concern of yours are the troubles of this land. But it was not by design of your own that you became embroiled in them, and so I will not blame such part as you have played, a valiant one, I doubt not. But I pray you, allow me first to speak with the King of Rohan, my neighbour, and once my friend." "What have you to say, Théoden King? Will you have peace with me, and all the aid that my knowledge, founded in long years, can bring? Shall we make our counsels together against evil days, and repair our injuries with such good will that our estate shall both come to fairer flower than ever before?"
Still Théoden did not answer. Whether he strove with anger or doubt, none could say. Éomer spoke.
"Lord, hear me," he said. "Now we feel the peril that we were warned of. Have we ridden forth to victory, only to stand at last amazed by an old liar with honey on his forked tongue? So would the trapped wolf speak to the hounds if he could. What aid can he give to you, forsooth? All he desires is to escape from his plight. But will you parley with this dealer in treachery and murder? Remember Théodred at the fords, and the grave of Harmer in Helm's Deep."
"If we speak of poisoned tongues, what shall we say of yours, young serpent?"
said Saruman, and the flash of his anger was now plain to see.
"But come, Éomer, Éomund's son," he went on in his soft voice again, "to every man his part. Valour in arms is yours, and you win high honour thereby. Slay whom your lord names as enemies, and be content. Meddle not in policies which you don't understand. But maybe, if you become a king, you'll find that he must choose his friends with care. The friends of Saruman and the power of Orthanc cannot be lightly thrown aside, whatever grievances, real or fancied, may lie behind. You've won a battle, but not a war, and that with help on which you cannot count again. But you may find the shadow of the wood at your own door next. It is wayward and senseless, and has no love for men. But, my lord of Rohan, am I to be called a murderer, because valiant men have fallen in battle? If you go to war, needlessly, for I didn't desire it, then men will be slain. But if I'm a murderer on that account, then all the house of Eol is stained with murder, for they've fought many wars, and assailed many who defied them. Yet with some they've afterwards made peace, none the worse for being politic. I say, Théoden King, shall we have peace and friendship, you and I? It is ours to command."
"We will have peace," said Théoden at last, thickly and with an effort.
Several of the riders cried out gladly. Théoden held up his hand.
"Yes, we will have peace," he said, now in a clear voice. "We will have peace, when you and all your works have perished, and the works of your dark master to whom you would deliver us. You're a liar, Saruman, and a corrupter of men's hearts. You hold out your hand to me, and I perceive only a finger of the claw of Mordor, cruel and cold, even if your war on me was just, as it was not. For were you 10 times as wise, you would have no right to rule me and mine for your own profit as you desired. Even so, what will you say of your tortures in Westfold, and the children that lie dead there? And they hewed Harmer's body before the gates of the Hornburg, after he was dead? When you hang from a gibbet at your window for the sport of your own crows, I will have peace with you and Orthanc.
So much for the House of Aeol. A lesser son of great sires am I, but I don't need to lick your fingers. Turn elsewhither, but I fear your voice has lost its charm.
The riders gazed up at Théoden like men startled out of a dream. Harsh as an old raven's, their master's voice sounded in their ears after the music of Saruman. But Saruman for a while was beside himself with wrath. He leaned over the rail as if he would smite the king with a staff. To some, suddenly, it seemed that they saw a snake coiling itself to strike.
"Gibbets and crows," he hissed, and they shuddered at the hideous change. "Dotard, what is the House of Aeol but a thatched barn where brigands drink in the reek and their breaths roll on the floor among the dogs? Too long have they escaped the gibbet themselves, but the noose cubs, slowly in the drawing, tight and hard in the end. Hang if you will."
Now his voice changed, and he slowly mastered himself.
"I know not why I have had the patience to speak to you, for I need you not, nor your little band of gallopers, as swift to fly as to advance. Théoden, horsemaster, long ago I offered you a state beyond your merit and your wit. I have offered it again, so that those whom you mislead may clearly see the choice of roads. You give me brag and abuse, so be it. Go back to your huts. But you, Gandalf, for you at least I'm grieved, feeling for your shame. How comes it that you can endure such company? For you are proud, Gandalf, and not without reason, having a noble mind and eyes that look both deep and far. Even now will you not listen to my counsel?" Gandalf stirred and looked up. "What have you to say that you didn't say at our last meeting?" he asked. "Or perhaps you have things to unsay?"
Saruman paused.
"Unsay?" he mused, as if puzzled. "Unsay? I endeavoured to advise you for your own good, but you scarcely listened. You're proud and don't love advice, having indeed a store of your own wisdom. But on that occasion you erred, I think, misconstruing my intentions wilfully. I fear that in my eagerness to persuade you I lost patience. And indeed I regret it. For I bore you no ill will, and even now I bear none, though you return to me in the company of the violent and the ignorant. How should I? Are we not both members of a high and ancient order, most excellent in Middle-earth? Our friendship would profit us both alike. Much we could still accomplish together to heal the disorders of the world. Let us understand one another, and dismiss from thought these lesser folk. Let them wait on our decisions. For the common good, I'm willing to redress the past and to receive you. Will you not consult with me? Will you not come up?"
So great was the power that Saruman exerted in this last effort that none that stood within hearing were unmoved. But now the spell was wholly different. They heard the gentle remonstrance of a kindly king with an erring but much-loved minister. But they were shut out, listening at a door to words not meant for them, ill-mannered children or stupid servants overhearing the elusive discourse of their elders, and wondering how it could affect their lot. Of loftier mould these two were made, reverend and wise. It was inevitable that they should make an alliance. Gandalf would ascend into the tower to discuss deep things beyond their comprehension in the high chambers of Orthanc. The door would be closed, and they would be left outside, dismissed to await allotted work or punishment. Even in the mind of Théoden the thought took shape, like a shadow of doubt.
"He will betray us. He will go. We shall be lost."
Then Gandalf laughed. The fantasy vanished like a puff of smoke.
"Saruman! Saruman!" said Gandalf, still laughing. "Saruman, you missed your path in life. You should have been the king's jester and earned your bread and stripes too, by mimicking his counsellors. Ah, me!"
He paused, getting the better of his mirth.
"Understand one another. I fear I'm beyond your comprehension. But you, Saruman, I understand now too well. I keep a clearer memory of your arguments and deeds than you suppose. When last I visited you, you were the jailer of Mordor,
and there I was to be sent. Nay, the guest who has escaped from the roof will think twice before he comes back in by the door. Nay, I don't think I will come up. But listen, Saruman, for the last time, will you not come down? Isengard has proved less strong than your hope and fancy made it. So may other things in which you still have trust. Would it not be well to leave it for a while? To turn to a new thing, perhaps? Think well, Saruman. Will you not come down?
A shadow passed over Saruman's face. Then it went deathly white. Before he could conceal it, they saw through the mask the anguish of a mind in doubt, loathing to stay and dreading to leave its refuge. For a second he hesitated, and no one breathed. Then he spoke, and his voice was shrill and cold. Pride and hate were conquering him.
"Will I come down?" he mocked. "Does an unarmed man come down to speak with robbers out of doors? I can hear you well enough here. I'm no fool, and I don't trust you, Gandalf. They don't stand openly on my stairs, but I know where the wildwood demons are lurking, at your command."
"The treacherous are ever distrustful," answered Gandalf wearily. "But you needn't fear for your skin. I don't wish to kill you or hurt you. As you would know if you really understood me, and I have the power to protect you, I am giving you a last chance. You can leave Orthanc free if you choose."
"That sounds well," sneered Saruman. "Very much in the manner of Gandalf the Great, so condescending and so very kind. I don't doubt that you would find Orthanc commodious and my departure convenient, but why should I wish to leave? And what do you mean by free? There are conditions, I presume."
"Reasons for leaving you can see from your windows," answered Gandalf. "Others will occur to your thought. Your servants are destroyed and scattered. Your neighbours you have made your enemies. And you have cheated your new master, or tried to do so. When his eye turns hither, it will be the red eye of wrath. But when I say free, I mean free. Free from bond, of chain or command. To go where you will, even to Mordor, Saruman, if you desire. But you will first surrender to me the key of Orthanc, and your staff. They shall be pledges of your conduct, to be returned later, if you merit them."
Saruman's face grew livid, twisted with rage, and a red light was kindled in his eyes. He laughed wildly.
"Later," he cried, and his voice rose to a scream. "Later? Yes, when you also have the keys of Barad-dûr itself, I suppose, and the crowns of 7 kings, and the rods of the 5 wizards, and have purchased yourself a pair of boots many sizes larger than those that you wear now. A modest plan, hardly one in which my help is needed. I have other things to do. Don't be a fool. If you wish to treat with me, while you have a chance, go away and come back when you're sober, and leave behind these cutthroats and small ragtag that dangle at your tail. Good day."
He turned and left the balcony.
"Come back, Saruman," said Gandalf in a commanding voice.
To the amazement of the others, Saruman turned again, and as if dragged against his will, he came slowly back to the iron rail, leaning on it, breathing hard. His face was lined and shrunken. His hand clutched his heavy black staff like a claw.
"I didn't give you leave to go," said Gandalf sternly. "I have not finished. You have become a fool, Saruman, and yet pitiable. You might still have turned away from folly and evil, and have been of service. But you choose to stay and gnaw the ends of your old plots. Stay then, but I warn you. You won't easily come out again. Not unless the dark hands of the East stretch out to take you, Saruman," he cried, and his voice grew in power and authority. "Behold, I am not Gandalf the Grey, whom you betrayed. I am Gandalf the White, who has returned from death. You have no colour now, and I cast you from the Order and from the Council."
He raised his hand, and spoke slowly in a clear, cold voice.
"Saruman, your staff is broken."
There was a crack, and the staff split asunder in Saruman's hand, and the head of it fell down at Gandalf's feet.
"Go!"
said Gandalf. With a cry, Saruman fell back and crawled away. At that moment a heavy, shining thing came hurtling down from above. It glanced off the iron rail, even as Saruman left it,
and passing close to Gandalf's head, it smote the stair on which he stood. The rail rang and snapped. The stair cracked and splintered in glittering sparks, but the ball was unharmed. It rolled on down the steps, a globe of crystal, dark, but glowing with a heart of fire. As it bounded away towards a pool, Pippin ran after it and picked it up. "The murderous rogue!" cried Éomer, but Gandalf was unmoved.
"No, that was not thrown by Saruman," he said, "nor even at his bidding, I think. It came from a window far above, a parting shot from Master Wormtongue, I fancy, but ill-aimed. The aim was poor, maybe, because he couldn't make up his mind which he hated more, you or Saruman," said Aragorn. "That may be so," said Gandalf. "Small comfort will those two have in their companionship. They will gnaw one another with words. But the punishment is just. If Wormtongue ever comes out of Orthanc alive, it will be more than he deserves. Here, my lad, I'll take that. I didn't ask you to handle it," he cried, turning sharply and seeing Pippin coming up the steps, slowly, as if he were bearing a great weight. He went down to meet him and hastily took the dark globe from the hobbit, wrapping it in the folds of his cloak. "I'll take care of this," he said. "It's not a thing, I guess, that Saruman would have chosen to cast away." "But he may have other things to cast," said Gimli. "If that's the end of the debate, let's go out of stone so at least." "It is the end," said Gandalf. "Let us go." They turned their backs on the doors of Orthanc and went down. The riders hailed the king with joy and saluted Gandalf. The spell of Saruman was broken. They had seen him come at call and crawl away, dismissed. "Well, that's done," said Gandalf. "Now I must find Treebeard and tell him how things have gone."
"He'll have guessed, surely," said Merry. "Were they likely to end any other way?"
"Not likely," answered Gandalf, "though they came to the balance of a hair. But I had reasons for trying, some merciful and some less so. First Saruman was shown that the power of his voice was waning. He cannot be both tyrant and counsellor. When the plot is ripe, it remains no longer secret. Yet he fell into the trap, and tried to deal with his victims piecemeal, while others listened. Then I gave him a last choice, and a fair one, to renounce both Mordor and his private schemes, and make amends by helping us in our need. He knows our need, none better. Great service he could have rendered, but he's chosen to withhold it, and keep the power of Orthanc. He will not serve, only command."
"He lives now in terror of the shadow of Mordor, and yet he still dreams of riding the storm."
"Unhappy fool. He'll be devoured if the power of the East stretches out its arms to Isengard. We can't destroy Orthanc from without, but Sauron, who knows what he can do?"
"And what if Sauron doesn't conquer? What will you do to him?" asked Pippin.
"I? Nothing," said Gandalf. "I won't do anything to him. I don't wish for mastery. What will become of him, I can't say. I grieve that so much that was good now festers in the tower. Still, for us, things have not gone badly. Strange are the turns of fortune. Often does hatred hurt itself. I guess that, even if we had entered in, we could have found new treasures in Orthanc more precious than the thing which Wormtongue threw down at us."
A shrill shriek, suddenly cut off, came from an open window high above.
"It seems that Saruman thinks so too," said Gandalf. "Let's leave them."
They returned now to the ruins of the gate. Hardly had they passed out under the arch, when, from under the shadows of the piled stones where they had stood, Treebeard and a dozen other Ents came striding up. Aragorn, Gimli and Legolas gazed at them in wonder.
"Here are three of my companions, Treebeard," said Gandalf. "I've spoken of them, but you haven't yet seen them."
He named them one by one. The old Ent looked at them long and searchingly, and spoke to them in turn. Last he came to Legolas.
"So you have come all the way from Mirkwood, my good elf? A very great forest it used to be."
"And still is," said Legolas, "but not so great that we who dwell there ever tire of seeing new trees.
I should dearly love to journey in Fangorn's wood. I scarcely passed beyond the eaves of it, and I didn't wish to turn back." Treebeard's eyes gleamed with pleasure.
"I hope you may have your wish ere the hills be much older," he said.
"I'll come, if I have the fortune," said Legolas. "I've made a bargain with my friend that, if all goes well, we'll visit Fangorn together, by your leave."
"Any elf that comes with you will be welcome," said Treebeard.
"The friend I speak of isn't an elf," said Legolas. "I mean Gimli, Gloin's son here." Gimli bowed low, and the axe slipped from his belt and clattered on the ground.
"Oh, no," said Treebeard, looking dark-eyed at him. "A dwarf and an axe-bearer? I have goodwill to elves, but you ask much. This is a strange friendship."
"Strange it may seem," said Legolas, "but while Gimli lives, I shall not come to Fangorn alone. His axe is not for trees, but for Orknecks, O Fangorn, master of Fangorn's wood. 42 he hewed in the battle."
"Ho, come now," said Treebeard. "That's a better story. Well, well, things will go as they will, and there's no need to hurry to meet them. But now we must part for a while. Day is drawing to an end, yet Gandalf says you must go ere nightfall, and the Lord of the Mark is eager for his own house."
"Yes, we must go, and go now," said Gandalf. "I fear that I must take your gatekeepers from you, but you'll manage well enough without them."
"Maybe I shall," said Treebeard, "but I shall miss them. We've become friends in so short a while that I think I must be getting hasty, growing backwards towards youth, perhaps. But they're the first new thing under sun or moon that I've seen for many a long, long day. I shan't forget them. I put their names into the long list. Ents will remember it. Ents the earth-born, old as mountains, the wide-walkers, water-drinking, and hungry as hunters, the hobbit children, the laughing folk, the little people. They shall remain friends as long as leaves are renewed. Fare you well. But if you hear news up in your pleasant land, in the Shire, send me word. You know what I mean, word or sight of the Entwives. Come yourselves if you can."
"We will," said Merry and Pippin together, and they turned away hastily. Treebeard looked at them and was silent for a while, shaking his head thoughtfully. Then he turned to Gandalf.
"So Saruman would not leave," he said. "I did not think he would. His heart is as rotten as a black horn's. Still, if I were overcome and all my trees destroyed, I would not come while I had one dark hole left to hide in."
"No," said Gandalf, "but you've not plotted to cover all the world with your trees and choke all other living things. But there it is. Saruman remains to nurse his hatred and weave again such webs as he can. He has the key of Orthanc, but he must not be allowed to escape."
"Indeed, no. Ents will see to that," said Treebeard. "Saruman shall not set foot beyond the rock without my leave. Ents will watch over him."
"Good," said Gandalf. "That is what I hoped. Now I can go and turn to other matters with one care the less. But you must be wary. The waters have gone down.
It will not be enough to put sentinels round the tower, I fear. I don't doubt that there were deep ways delved under Orthanc, and that Saruman hopes to go and come unmarked before long. If you will undertake the labour, I beg you to pour in the waters again, and do so until Isengard remains a standing pool, or you discover the outlets. When all the underground places are drowned, and the outlets blocked, then Saruman must stay upstairs and look out of the windows."
"Leave it to the Ents," said Treebeard. "We shall search the valley from head to foot and peer under every pebble. Trees are coming back to live here, old trees. Wild trees, the watchwood we will call it. Not a squirrel will go here, but I shall know of it. Leave it to Ents. Until 7 times the years in which he tormented us have passed, we shall not tire of watching him."
Chapter 11 The Palantir. The sun was shining behind the long western arm of the mountains when Gandalf and his companions, and the king with his riders, set out again from Isengard. Gandalf took Merry behind him, and Aragorn took Pippin. Two of the king's men went on ahead, riding swiftly, and passed soon out of sight down into the valley. The others followed at an easy pace. Ents in a solemn row stood like statues at the gate, with their long arms uplifted, but they made no sound. Merry and Pippin looked back when they had passed some way down the winding road. Sunlight was still shining in the sky, but long shadows reached over Isengard, grey ruins falling into darkness. Treebeard stood alone there now, like the distant stump of an old tree. The hobbits thought of their first meeting, upon the sunny ledge, far away on the borders of Fangorn. They came to the pillar of the White Hand. The pillar was still standing, but the graven hand had been thrown down and broken into small pieces. Right in the middle of the road the long forefinger lay, white in the dusk, its red nail darkening to black.
"The Ents pay attention to every detail," said Gandalf.
They rode on, and evening deepened in the valley.
"Are we riding far tonight, Gandalf?" asked Merry after a while. "I don't know how you feel with small ragtag dangling behind you, but the ragtag is tired and will be glad to stop dangling and lie down."
"So you heard that," said Gandalf. "Don't let it rankle. Be thankful no longer words were aimed at you. He had his eyes on you. If it is any comfort to your pride, I should say that, at the moment, you and Pippin are more in his thoughts than all the rest of us. Who you are, how you came there, and why, what you know, whether you were captured, and if so, how you escaped when all the orcs perished. It is with those little riddles that the great mind of Saruman is troubled. A sneer from him, Merry Arduk, is a compliment, if you feel honoured by his concern."
"Thank you," said Merry. "But it's a greater honour to dangle at your tail, Gandalf. For one thing, in that position one has a chance of putting a question a second time. Are we riding far tonight?" Gandalf laughed.
"A most unquenchable hobbit. All wizards should have a hobbit or two in their care, to teach them the meaning of the word, and to correct them. I beg your pardon, but I have given thought even to these simple matters. We will ride for a few hours, gently, until we come to the end of the valley. Tomorrow we must ride faster. When we came, we meant to go straight from Isengard back to the king's house at Edoras over the plains, a ride of some days. But we've taken thought and changed the plan. Messengers have gone ahead to Helm's Deep, to warn them that the king is returning tomorrow. He'll ride from there with many men to Dunharrow by paths among the hills. From now on no more than two or three together are to go openly over the land, by day or night, when it can be avoided."
"Nothing or a double helping is your way," said Merry. "I'm afraid I wasn't looking beyond tonight's bed. Where and what are Helm's Deep and all the rest of it? I don't know anything about this country."
"Then you'd best learn something, if you wish to understand what's happening. But not just now, and not from me. I've too many pressing things to think about."
"All right. I'll tackle Strider by the campfire. He's less testy. But why all this secrecy? I thought we'd won the battle."
"Yes, we've won, but only the first victory, and that in itself increases our danger. There was some link between Isengard and Mordor, which I've not yet fathomed. How they exchanged news I'm not sure, but they did so. The Eye of Barad-dûr will be looking impatiently towards the Wizard Vale, I think, and towards Rohan. The less it sees, the better."
The road passed slowly, winding down the valley. Now further, and now nearer, Isen flowed in its stony bed. Night came down from the mountains. All the mists were gone. A chill wind blew. The moon, now waxing round, filled the eastern sky with a pale, cold sheen. The shoulders of the mountain to their right sloped down to bare hills. The wide plains opened grey before them. At last they halted,
Then they turned aside, leaving the highway and taking to the sweet upland turf again. Going westward a mile or so, they came to a dale. It opened southward, leaning back into the slope of round Dol Baran, the last hill of the northern ranges, green-footed, crowned with heather. The sides of the glen were shaggy with last year's bracken, among which the tight-curled fronds of spring were just thrusting through the sweet-scented earth. Thorn bushes grew thick upon the low banks, and under them they made their camp, 2 hours or so before the middle of the night. They lit a fire in a hollow, down among the roots of a spreading hawthorn, tall as a tree, writhen with age, but hale in every limb. Buds were swelling at each twig's tip. Guards were set, two at a watch. The rest, after they had supped, wrapped themselves in a cloak and blanket and slept. The hobbits lay in a corner by themselves upon a pile of old bracken. Merry was sleepy, but Pippin now seemed curiously restless. The bracken cracked and rustled as he twisted and turned. "What's the matter?" asked Merry. "Are you lying on an anthill?" "No," said Pippin, "but I'm not comfortable. I wonder how long it is since I slept in a bed." Merry yawned. "Work it out on your fingers," he said. "But you must know how long it is since we left Lorien." "Oh, that," said Pippin. "I mean a real bed in a bedroom." "Well, Rivendell, then," said Merry. "But I could sleep anywhere tonight." "You had the luck, Merry," said Pippin softly, after a long pause. "You were riding with Gandalf." "Well, what of it?" "Did you get any news, any information out of him?"
"Yes, a good deal, more than usual. But you heard it all, or most of it. You were close by, and we were talking no secrets. But you can go with him tomorrow, if you think you'll get more out of him, and if he'll have you."
"Can I? Good. But he's close, isn't he? Not changed at all."
"Oh, yes, he is," said Merry, waking up a little, and beginning to wonder what was bothering his companion. "He has grown, or something. He can be both kinder and more alarming, merrier and more solemn than before, I think. He's changed, but we've not had a chance to see him much yet. But think of the last part of that business with Saruman. Remember Saruman was once Gandalf's superior, head of the council, whatever that may be exactly. He was Saruman the White. Gandalf is the White now. Saruman came when he was told, and his rod was taken. And then he was just told to go, and he went."
"Well, if Gandalf has changed at all, then he's closer than ever, that's all," Pippin argued. "That glass ball, now. He seemed mighty pleased with it.
He knows or guesses something about it. But does he tell us what?"
"No, not a word. Yet I picked it up, and I saved it from rolling into a pool."
"Here, I'll take that, my lad. That's all.
I wonder what it is. It felt so very heavy."
Pippin's voice fell very low, as if he was talking to himself. "Hallo," said Merry. "So that's what is bothering you. Now, Pippin, my lad, don't forget Gildor's saying, the one Sam used to quote, 'Do not meddle in the affairs of wizards, for they are subtle and quick to anger.'
But our whole life for months has been one long meddling in the affairs of wizards," said Pippin. "I should like a bit of information as well as danger. I should like a look at that ball."
"Go to sleep," said Merry. "You'll get information enough sooner or later. My dear Pippin, no took ever beat a brandy buck for inquisitiveness. But is this the time, I ask you?"
"All right. What's the harm in my telling you what I should like? A look at that stone."
"I know I can't have it, with old Gandalf sitting on it, like a hen on an egg. But it doesn't help much to get no more from you than a 'you can't have it, so go to sleep.'"
"Well, what else could I say?" said Merry.
"I'm sorry, Pippin, but you really must wait till the morning. I'll be as curious as you like after breakfast, and I'll help in any way I can at wizard wheedling. But I can't keep awake any longer. If I yawn any more, I shall split at the ears. Good night."
Pippin said no more. He lay still now, but sleep remained far away, and it was not encouraged by the sound of Merry breathing softly, asleep in a few minutes after saying good night. The thought of the dark globe seemed to grow stronger as all grew quiet. Pippin felt again its weight in his hands, and saw again the mysterious red depths into which he had looked for a moment. He tossed and turned and tried to think of something else.